7. The Girl Left Behind. Enrique knows he does not hate his mother, but with each passing day his resentment grows. After months with his mother, he can no longer contain it. He tells Lourdes she didn't care enough about her children to stay with them in Honduras. Did she think sending money could substitute for having his mother at his side? Or quell the loneliness he felt being moved from one relative to the next? Money doesn't solve anything, he tells her. He berates Lourdes for leaving him with a father she knew was irresponsible. Why didn't she put him with her own family who cared for his sister Belki? Why didn't she send enough money, thus forcing him to sell spices from the age of 10? Why did she send Belki so much more to cover tuition at a private school her aunt sent her to? Belki always got more from you, he says. If he was destitute, he had no one nearby who could help. How could I ask you for anything, he asks Lourdes. I would go a year without talking to you. He tells her he wanted to study. He just didn't want to have to beg his mother for the money. Belki is going to be a professional. Look at me, he says. Enrique tells Lourdes her biggest mistake was getting pregnant a year after arriving in the United States. You shouldn't have gotten pregnant until you knew your existing kids were okay, he says. Why did she continually promise to return for Christmas and then never show up? Once she knew he was in trouble sniffing glue, he asks her, how could she stay away? You left me, abandoned me, he tells her. You forgot about me. Nothing, he tells her, was gained by their long separation. People come here to prosper. You have nothing here. What have you accomplished? If she had stayed in Honduras, he would have turned out better. I wouldn't be this way if I had had two parents. A true mother, he tells Lourdes, isn't the person who carries you in her womb. It is someone who raises and nurtures you. My mother is my grandmother, Maria, he tells her. He warns Lourdes that she has no right to give him advice. You long ago lost the right to tell me what to do, he says. Then Enrique lands the most hurtful blow. He tells Lourdes he plans to leave her and return to Honduras in 2 years. I'm not going to do the same as you, stay here all my life. Lourdes expected Enrique to love her like the 5-year-old who clung to her in Honduras. She cries herself to sleep at night. She has been a good person, a good mother. Why is God punishing her? She must show Enrique he is terribly mistaken. What about the money I sent you, she says. I have witnesses. Whenever he asked for something specific, a television, a soccer ball, she sent it. Belki got more money only because her aunt lobbied Lourdes for funds for Belki's school tuition. Lourdes lived through extreme poverty and humiliating circumstances to send as much as possible to her children. For the first time, she tells Enrique about the struggles she too endured during their years apart. I killed myself trying to help you. She's not like some mothers she knows who leaves Honduras and forget their children, never call, never write. That's a mother a child can resent, even hate. I called, I wrote, she says. Blame your father, Lourdes says. He promised to take care of you while I was away. He abandoned you. Your father's family had equal responsibility to provide your needs. Instead, she says angrily, your grandmother Maria sent you to sell spices in the market, where you learned about drugs. You are what you are because you didn't want to study, Lourdes says. It's not my fault. I wanted you to study. You preferred to be on drugs. One night, as he sits down to dinner, Lourdes tells her son that if she had sent more money, he would have blown it on drugs. He sold the bed she bought him for drug money. Enrique, silent, pushes away from the table without touching his food. He should thank her for giving him life, Lourdes says. That alone gives her the right to give him advice and discipline. Lourdes thinks of how her own mother couldn't provide enough food for her children, how she could hate her too. When she was 8 years old, Lourdes sought out odd jobs. A neighbor gave her clothes to wash in the river twice a week. When she was 9, her mother dispatched Lourdes and Rosa Amalia, then 10, to work for a former neighbor as live-in maids. With no money, Lourdes quit elementary school. When she was 14, her mother sent her to live with her eldest brother Marco in southern Honduras. "My mother is sacred to me. I thank her for the little she did for us," Lourdes says. Enrique is harboring a silly resentment, she tells him. She didn't forget him. Why can't she get him to reason? He's an ungrateful brat. Lourdes gives her son a dark prediction. God is going to punish you, she says. Someday, she tells him, your daughter will treat you the way you now treat me. Enrique drinks more and more beer. Their fights are often sparked by Lourdes's advice. Don't drink and drive. Control your vices. Be more frugal. You can't spend $1,000 as if it were $10. Mira, hijo, look, son, she begins. Enrique cuts her off. All you do is yap, yap, yap. You keep sticking your nose into things that are none of your business, he tells her. She treats him as if he were still the infant she left behind. Didn't he fend for himself growing up? Didn't he hop freight trains across Mexico? Shut up, leave me in peace, he yells. Friends worry. They hear hatred in his voice. Enrique loves to contradict his mother to set her off, even when he knows she is right. He talks over her. He leaves his clothes and shoes strewn in the living room, empty beer cans on the front lawn. He tells Lourdes he's going out, then refuses to tell her where. Enrique makes Lourdes mad and guilty. She cooks his dinners, she packs his lunch, she washes his clothes at the laundromat. She drops off his car and insurance payments for him. She lends Enrique $20 here and there, more if he needs it. Would he have turned out different, she asks herself repeatedly, if she hadn't left him? For Enrique, alcohol is an escape from the fights. Almost all of the men on his paint crew, depressed to be away from home, are big drinkers. Unlike in Honduras, in the United States, beer is cheap. Some sip Budweiser on the job, stashing the cans in an empty paint bucket when the supervisor stops by. Most swing by a store to pick up a 12-pack at the end of the workday. At home, 4 men drink. One can chug 12 beers as Enrique drives him home from work. Enrique sucks down 10 beers on weeknights, often with friends in front of the house. He goes to bed at midnight or 1 a.m., getting up at 6 a.m. for work. On Saturday, the drinking begins at 4 p.m. Enrique and a housemate can down 48 beers together. Sometimes they drink until dawn. They head to work without sleeping. Enrique is breaking a promise he made to leave his addictions behind once he crossed into the United States. But he feels abnormal, as if he were crawling out of his skin if he isn't high. At least he's not sniffing glue. Going out to drink gets him out of the trailer, where 9 people live and Enrique must sleep on the living room sofa. It also gets him away from Lourdes. From Thursday through Sunday in the evenings, he goes to a local bar, a gray stucco building with plywood over the windows and a gravel parking lot. Inside, under a dark, low-slung ceiling, there are 4 pool tables, a long bar, and a jukebox that plays Latino music. He frequents a discotheque with a $7 entry fee. There are iron bars over the door. Inside, the walls are painted black. Next to the dance floor, a DJ plays norteña and ranchera music. Green and red lights cast a glow over the crowd. 8 women work as ficheras, Latinas who will sit and talk to men willing to buy them $10 beers. 6 beers buys 2 hours of companionship, $5 a dance. A few ficheras provide sex for more. Enrique and his friends splurge at a topless bar. Women dance on a platform. Men tuck dollar bills into their bikini bottoms. $20 buys an invitation to a smaller room, where a dancer brushes her breasts against the men's faces. A lap dance is more. Enrique usually spends $150 each visit. One night, he invites his friends to this bar, which charges $15 each to get in. And he pays for everything. He blows $300. When he has money for drinks and marijuana, Enrique is calm and quiet. Otherwise, he gets testy. Sometimes Enrique doesn't have enough money to pay Lourdes his share of the bills. He isn't sending as much money to his daughter as he could. Lourdes tries to scare Enrique straight, playing on his ignorance of the United States. "If you keep this up," she warns, "I'll have you locked up." She tells him that parents can do that in the United States, even if children haven't committed a crime. Enrique soon learns that Lourdes is lying. 4 months after Enrique arrives in the United States, his work hours get cut. He decides to accompany a painter on his crew to find temporary jobs in South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia. Even on the road, living out of motel rooms, Enrique maintains one ritual. Each Sunday, he telephones his girlfriend, Maria Isabel, in Honduras. She waits for his call at the home of one of Lourdes's cousins. When she answers the telephone, she is so overcome with emotion, she cannot speak. Enrique talks for 1 or 2 hours. Maria Isabel cries and cries. "Maria Isabel, say something, anything," Enrique pleads. "I miss you. I love you. Don't forget me," she says. He sends her $100 or more a month. He vows he will be back in Honduras within 2 years. Eventually, Maria Isabel tells him of some of the problems she too is having. Enrique's family constantly criticizes her. "Don't pay attention to them," he tells her. "It is not that easy," she says. Maria Isabel lives across the street from Enrique's grandmother, sister, and 3 aunts. When she was 8 months pregnant, one of Enrique's uncles insinuated that the baby didn't belong to Enrique. Lourdes prepares for Enrique's return and their first Christmas together again. She has grown to dread the holiday. Year after year, she promised Enrique and Belki she would see them for Christmas. Each time she let them down. Each Christmas she cried and became more hard-hearted. She wished that Christmas would never arrive. This year, paying Enrique's smuggler has left her strapped for money. She puts up a small plastic Christmas tree. She crowds it with ornaments. "What an ugly tree," Enrique says. "You put so many things on it that it looks like a piñata." In Honduras, his aunt had a real tree. She set up a nativity scene with hay inside her house. There were fireworks. The whole family gathered at midnight for a special meal. On Christmas Eve, Lourdes goes to bed early. Enrique goes out drinking with friends. He comes home late and drunk. The next morning, Lourdes gives her son a shirt. Enrique doesn't have a gift for his mother. New Year's Eve is better. Lourdes has never celebrated New Year's Eve in the United States. It brings back too many memories of Honduras, where she would run home from a party at midnight to hug her mother. This year, she goes to a party with Enrique. At midnight, she kisses her son. Enrique hugs her back hard. "Happy New Year. I love you," he tells his mother. For the first time in all her years in the United States, Lourdes doesn't cry on New Year's Eve. Honduras. Criticism of Maria Isabel by Enrique's family grows. Gloria's grandchildren play next door. They return and repeat everything they've overheard Enrique's family say about Maria Isabel. Jasmine, they say, is dirty and ill-cared for. The girl loves to build little houses out of mud behind Gloria's house. Maria Isabel changes her clothes several times a day. Still, in Gloria's disheveled home, where the back door is left open to the muddy yard, her efforts are futile. Enrique's sister says that Jasmine is barefoot, badly dressed, her hair uncombed. She is skinny and pale and often has a cough. Why, Enrique's family asks, did Maria Isabel stop breastfeeding her after 6 months? If Enrique sends money, why doesn't Maria Isabel take Jasmin to a good private doctor, not the public clinic? Maria Isabel cooks, cleans, and goes out on errands and purchases for Gloria's store. She walks Gloria's grandchild to kindergarten. She helps care for the four children in the house while Gloria tends to customers in her little grocery store. Belki understands Maria Isabel's dilemma. She, too, has always lived as a guest in someone else's home, feeling pressure to make herself useful. Still concerned about Jasmin, Belki hounds Maria Isabel. Why is the girl all dirty? You need to take better care of her. Sometimes Maria Isabel doesn't respond. Other times she bristles. No, I take care of my girl. They have no right to criticize. One of Enrique's aunts has a son who is just as skinny as Jasmin. Should she have to explain that her breasts stopped giving milk? If the women next door are so concerned about Enrique's interests, why did some of them treat him like a dog, she wonders, when he lived in their home? The women next door have another reproach. Maria Isabel is misspending the hard-earned money, $100 to $150 a month, that Enrique diligently sends his daughter. Maria Isabel spends most of the money on Jasmin. She also gives $15 a month to Gloria. She stocks Gloria's refrigerator with fruit, milk, and chicken. She gives Gloria's daughter's pocket change. She sends $10 across town to her mother to help her buy heart and asthma medicine. To the women next door, Maria Isabel is showering money on her family that rightfully belongs to Enrique's child. They know exactly how much she gets. Maria Isabel's money comes in a joint wire that Enrique and Lourdes send to one of Lourdes's relatives. Enrique's aunt Miriam vigilantly watches when Maria Isabel goes shopping, whom she goes with, how many bags they have when they return. Miriam, a hairstylist, hears that Maria Isabel has bought hair dye for herself and Gloria's daughters. Miriam is livid. She is so broke she can barely buy used clothes for her three children. When she visits Gloria's house, she sees a can of Jasmin's powdered milk spilled on the floor. Gloria's grandchildren are racing around with fistfuls of white powder in their hands. Another day, Miriam scolds Maria Isabel for paying $150 for a chest of drawers to store Jasmin's clothes. You were a fool to buy such an expensive piece of furniture. My cousin could have gotten you a better one for a third of the price, Miriam tells her. Maria Isabel seethes. She says nothing. She is grateful for what Enrique sends. Still, most of the money pays for diapers, clothes, medicine, and food for his daughter. Powdered milk alone costs $20 a month. Maria Isabel has spent most of her life deprived of decent clothing. Can't she buy a dress or splurge $2.50 to get her hair dyed? She cannot live with her Aunt Gloria, who is in financial distress, without helping. Miriam, a single mother, is desperate for money. Since the birth of her third child, she has cleaned a sister's house for $35 a month and food. As each of her children begins elementary school, Miriam's costs rise. They need books, supplies, and $1.50 per day for lunch at school. Enrique doesn't send me a dime, she moans. His only wire has been $20 on her birthday. She remembers changing Enrique's diapers as a baby, and how later, when he was a teen, she looked out for him. When Enrique was a glue sniffer living in his grandmother's house, she cooked his meals. Now, when she is in dire need, all of Enrique's money flows to the girl next door. She isn't spying on Maria Isabel, Miriam tells her family. She's just protecting Enrique's infant by demanding that Maria Isabel be a better mom. Does Enrique know, Miriam angrily asks her sisters, that Maria Isabel sends money across town to her mother? When Jasmin turns 8 months old, Miriam mails Enrique a letter. Your daughter isn't being well cared for, she writes. Maria Isabel is misspending your money. I've seen some of the clothes you sent Jasmine strewn in the dirt behind Gloria's house. Enrique recalls that when he visited Gloria's house, the children there were dirty. He asks Miriam to keep an eye on Jasmine. On the phone, he also chides Maria Isabel. If you don't take good care of that girl, I will come to Honduras and take her away from you. For a moment, Maria Isabel is silent. Then her voice turns stiff. No one takes my daughter away from me. Gloria is fed up with the digs at Maria Isabel, how her actions are scrutinized, how Enrique's family tries to control her. Stop bothering Maria Isabel. You are driving me nuts. Stop criticizing her, she tells the women next door. Gloria's grandson Ayan plays rough with Jasmine, who is smaller. He picks her up by the waist and throws her to the ground. He bites her and pulls her hair. When Jasmine is 9 months old, Ayan plops her inside Gloria's green wheelbarrow. From the porch of her grandmother's home, Belki screams, Ayan, leave the girl alone! Ayan is already pushing the wheelbarrow. It tips. Jasmine tumbles to the ground. She wails. Maria Isabel is out on an errand. Gloria, Ayan has thrown the girl off the wheelbarrow, Belki yells. Gloria snaps. She shouts across the dirt street that divides their homes. You think this child is an assassin? All you do is talk shit. You stick your noses in everything. She curses. She tells them to mind their own business. Then she offers up Jasmine. Here she is. Take her. You can raise her. Let Enrique send money to you, she says. If the dollars are causing you to make all these allegations, keep the damn dollars. For months, the families don't cross the street or speak. But Gloria's grandchildren do. They hear the women next door say they think Maria Isabel is having an affair. When she's out doing errands for Gloria, they say, she's really seeing a boyfriend. Maria Isabel is enraged. They are sullying one of the few things she has, her honor. Whenever Maria Isabel sets off on an errand, one of Enrique's aunts steps outside and inquires across the street, ¿A dónde vas? Where are you off to? Jasmine will soon turn 1 year old. Lourdes and Enrique send $400 and instructions. They want a joint birthday party for Jasmine and Miriam's 1-year-old daughter. That way, Lourdes figures, there will be a video to send north of everyone together. Maria Isabel feels she is being forced to have her daughter's celebration with women who have maligned her as a bad mother. She has barely stepped into their home since Jasmine's birth. On Jasmine's birthday, Maria Isabel dresses her in the red dress and white shoes Enrique and Lourdes sent for the party. She sends Jasmine next door. Maria Isabel stays behind, sobbing. Gloria finally tells Maria Isabel that she should go next door long enough to be in the video for Enrique. Jasmine and the other children have already taken turns whacking her piñata. Maria Isabel arrives as Jasmine is blowing out candles on her Winnie the Pooh cake. She balances Jasmine on her hip, nervously adjusting her daughter's party hat. Happy birthday to you, the children sing in English. Maria Isabel does not sing. She wipes away tears. A half hour after arriving, she retreats to Gloria's. Enrique has a short lull in work. He stops sending money. Maria Isabel finds a job sanding chairs at a small furniture factory for $35 a week. United States. A year after Enrique's arrival, Lourdes's boyfriend smuggles his 14-year-old son into the United States. The boy was 8 years old when his father left Honduras. That's when the boy started drinking and getting into fights. His father hopes that bringing him to the United States will straighten out the teenager. Instead, he finds new troubles. Teachers constantly call his father in to discuss his behavior. After 6 months, he drops out of school. Enrique blames the boy's father for his aggressiveness and penchant to fight. As a boy, Enrique says he never had a father to protect him. If his father had been with him, he wouldn't be that way, Enrique says. He wouldn't be in trouble. The teen and Enrique share a room and drink together. Lourdes fears that the boy is reinforcing Enrique's sense of abandonment. Enrique drinks more and more. His eyes are red from smoking marijuana. After work, he eats, showers, and goes out to play pool and drink late into the night. Enrique calls Maria Isabel less often, every 2 weeks, then every month. He tells her he wants to bring her to the United States in a year. But he hasn't saved any money for a smuggler. Enrique has never returned to his low, sniffing glue. Now, a few days before Christmas, 22 months after he left Honduras, beer and marijuana are no longer enough. He ends the workday by pouring a little paint thinner into an empty Pepsi can. He brings it home. He does the same the next night. The thinner doesn't give him as good a high as Honduran glue, but it's handy. Over the holidays, his family and others who share the trailer move into a newer three-bedroom duplex. It has a big kitchen and a living room with three sofas draped in lilac floral slipcovers. There is enough space to hang a painting of the Virgin of Guadalupe, a wooden carving of the map of Honduras, and a small American flag. Still, the home is crowded. There is little room for Enrique to hide his growing habit. Twice in 2 weeks, Lourdes has seen her son hold a smelly handkerchief over his nose. She never steps inside Enrique's bedroom. One morning, concerned that he hasn't gotten up for work, she walks in. She smells something funny, like paint. "What are you using?" she demands. "Nothing. Nothing!" She asks about the smell. Enrique yells at her. Lourdes senses that he is hiding something. For a few days, Enrique stays cooped up in his bedroom, listening to reggaeton music. He has been sniffing thinner for 2 weeks. One night, he decides to go out. He walks through the living room toward the front door. He is hiding something under his arm. "What do you have there? Show me," Lourdes says from the living room sofa. "None of your business." Enrique tries to brush past her. Lourdes jumps up and grabs Enrique by the shirt. She smells paint thinner. She's asked friends some questions. Now she knows what the smell means. Enrique shakes himself loose. Lourdes's words tumble out. She doesn't care that her boyfriend and three of his relatives are in the living room listening. "You're broken, ruined, a drug addict. Why did you even come here? To finish screwing yourself up?" Enrique curses. "You're a disgrace. Get your act together. Instead of seeing you this way, I wish God would take you from me," Lourdes says. "If you keep sniffing thinner," Lourdes tells him, "you have to move out." She must think of her daughter. Enrique does not respond. He peels out of the gravel driveway in his car. Lourdes is despondent. She worries that he will kill himself driving recklessly. For the first time in her life, Lourdes feels as though she wants to die. Maybe if she were gone, she tells herself, Enrique would know what it is truly like not to have a mother. That night, Enrique realizes that his body cannot withstand the thinner. Each time he inhales it, the left side of his head, where he took the worst of the beating on top of the train, aches badly. His left eyelid, which still droops slightly from the assault, pulses and twitches. He has excruciating pain when he turns his head. He stops sniffing. He's not doing it because his mother wants him to. He is doing it for himself. He focuses on his old habit, drinking. One morning at 2 a.m., Enrique is caught doing 55 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. He gets tickets for speeding and having an open container of beer in his car. The sticker on his license plate is expired. Police give him a breath test. They impound the car and take him to jail, where he spends the night. Lourdes sends her boyfriend to bail him out. Enrique's license is revoked for a week. Many of the men in his paint crew drive drunk, nearly four times as many Hispanic drivers as non-Hispanic drivers in North Carolina have been charged with driving while impaired. Enrique's workmates tell him not to worry. The government, they say, just wants you to pay a lot of money and tell a judge you are very sorry. The real problems, they tell him, begin with your third arrest. Enrique pays an attorney and the government $1,000. He tells a judge he is very sorry. Honduras. Life in Gloria's house has turned tense. Maria Isabel moved in because it was less crowded than her mother's hut. Now, 12 people crowd Gloria's two-bedroom house. Maria Isabel shares a bedroom with 5 others. Gloria's store has gone bust. The only other one in the house with a job is Gloria's husband, who makes $125 a month. Her salary plus what Enrique sends isn't enough for Maria Isabel to support 2 households, Gloria's and her mother's. She has to get away from Enrique's sister and aunts. Slowly, she has come to hate them. "I can't take it anymore," she tells Gloria. She'll return to her mother's primitive hut, she decides. Her mother and younger sister will help provide Jasmine, now 1.5 years old, with better care. She arranges for Enrique to send money for his daughter directly to herself instead of through his family. She does not give Enrique's family next door an address where she can be reached. Maria Isabel's mother, Eva, lives in a hut perched on a mountainside in a neighborhood called Los Tubos, 8 square blocks named after an above-ground water pipe that carries water from holding tanks on top of the mountain to Tegucigalpa below. On top of the mountain, Tegucigalpa's highest, shrouded in wisps of clouds by day, bathed in an orange glow of lights by night, stands a towering statue of Jesus. The gray statue stretches out both arms. They reach down toward the residents of the city below. The road up to Eva's is so steep that many cars can't get up it. Then there is a rutted dirt road, followed by a narrow mud and clay trail that zigzags upward. Maria Isabel must use the roots of a large rubber tree to step up to her mother's tiny wooden hut, which clings to the hillside. 9 people sleep inside. There has been one improvement since she left 6 years before. A relative built a small cinder block house next door. It has a bathroom, which Maria Isabel's family can use. Most children in Los Tubos don't go on to junior high because reaching the nearest school requires bus fare. Men work as bricklayers, women clean houses in wealthy neighborhoods. Still, as one of the city's oldest neighborhoods, it is a small step above where Gloria's and Enrique's families live. Water, which flowed through the tap every 2 weeks in Gloria's house, is available here every other day. Many wooden huts have been upgraded to small brick or cinder block homes, some 2 or even 3 stories high. Their windows have glass panes instead of wooden shutters. Almost everyone has a refrigerator. Most in Los Tubos are longtime residents, but Maria Isabel's family are relative newcomers. They bought a lot in 1980 as homes were being built farther and farther up the hill. Above Maria Isabel's hut, there are mostly lush green slopes where it is too steep to build even the smallest place. Maria Isabel's family, among the poorest in Los Tubos, eats twice a day. They have no refrigerator. They cook on 2 small burners. All that has kept disaster away has been Maria Isabel's oldest sister, who sends money from Texas where she lives. Still, Maria Isabel's life gets better. 6 days a week at 11 a.m., Maria Isabel sets out for her new job at a children's clothing store at the Mall Multiplaza downtown. From the back of the store, sales girls ask Maria Isabel for a certain shoe and size. She fetches it. She shoves the box through a small opening in the wall. The light-filled mall, where Tegucigalpa's well-heeled citizens shop, has beige marble floors, potted indoor palms, air conditioning, and glass elevators. She gets home at 10 p.m. The job pays $120 a month. Jasmine puts on weight. Both Maria Isabel's mother and her younger sister care for her while Maria Isabel works. Jasmine plays with her six dolls, giving them baths in an outdoor concrete trough the family uses to hold water. She brushes the doll's hair. Afterward, she runs inside. "I bathed the baby," she announces to her grandmother, a wiry, muscular woman with salt-and-pepper hair. She chases her grandmother's black-and-white chicks, making them scurry across the kitchen floor. She plays dress-up with a five-year-old girl next door, or Agua de Limón, where they lock hands and swing each other around in circles. When Jasmine gets hungry, Ava scrambles her eggs with black beans. She changes her whenever she gets dirty. In the afternoon, Jasmine goes to her grandmother and demands money. "Quiero pisto." Ava hands her a little change. Jasmine crawls down a steep flight of stairs to a tiny bodega below. She peers through the black iron bars on the door and points. "Those, I want those," Jasmine says. The store owner hands her a small bag of hot pork rinds. Jasmine makes her way back up the steep slope. Each day, the girl reminds Maria Isabel more and more of her father. Like Enrique, she stands slightly knock-kneed, her pelvis thrust out, her bottom tucked under. She has his deep, raspy voice. She has the same temperament as Enrique and Lourdes. She is testy, a stubborn fighter who stands her ground. When she turns two, Maria Isabel takes Jasmine to talk to her father on the telephone. Jasmine loves to accompany her mother downtown on Sundays, to the Ashti's cell internet, where they can dial Enrique more cheaply. Maria Isabel knows his number by heart. She sits before the gray computer, and Jasmine stands between her legs. "Mom, pass the phone," Jasmine demands, reaching for the computer headset. "I love you, Enrique," she says. Then, "When are you coming here?" Jasmine returns to her grandmother's and proudly announces, "I spoke with my daddy, Enrique." Often the things Jasmine tells her father are lines that Maria Isabel prods her to say. "It doesn't matter," says her grandmother. "They are strangers," says Ava. "But they are blood." Ava often shows Jasmine the eight photos Enrique has sent of himself. Jasmine knows her father sends her things. When Enrique's aunt Rosa Amalia asks her where she got the beautiful gold and emerald earrings she wears, Jasmine touches them. "They are from my daddy, Enrique," she adds. "He says he loves me a lot." Ava tells Jasmine that someday she will go see her father in an airplane. Jasmine figures her father must have left on an airplane, too. Several times a day when she hears one in the sky, she stops what she is doing and races outside. She looks up, her eyes bright. She thrusts both arms up and waves madly. "Adios, Papi Enrique," she yells. United States. Enrique has been living with his mother for nearly 2.5 years. One evening, Lourdes and her boyfriend are watching a soap opera on the living room television. Enrique and a friend are playing cards down the hallway on the kitchen table. Enrique is wound up tight. He's working at a company that pushes everyone to paint excessively fast. Enrique and his friend throw the cards down hard on the kitchen table. Each time they slap a card down, they yell. Lourdes walks into the kitchen. She looks cross. "What are you doing?" she demands. If you don't want noise, you should live alone. You're an ignoramus, she answers. Enrique likes to goad his mother by making noise. At dinner, he burps loudly and doesn't excuse himself. He bangs his spoon on the kitchen table. He slams doors. He plays music at high volume. He yells. He thinks it is incredibly funny to see her get mad. Lourdes goes back to the television. Enrique and his friend slap the cards down harder and harder. Lourdes stomps into the kitchen. Her boyfriend knows trouble is near. He soon follows. Be quiet, she orders. Enrique answers badly. You must respect me. Don't forget I am your mother. I gave birth to you. I don't love you as if you were my mother. I love my grandmother. I gave birth to you. That's not my fault. Lourdes grabs Enrique's shirt around the shoulders. Enrique pushes his chair back and bolts up. Lourdes slaps him on the mouth, hard. Enrique grabs her two hands near her neck to prevent further blows. Lourdes assumes that he is trying to grab her throat. Let go of me, she screams. Lourdes's boyfriend pulls them apart. Then he ushers Enrique outside. Enrique is crying. By the next day, all has returned to normal. Once, Enrique would have apologized. Today, there are no words of regret. With others, Enrique is openly affectionate, especially with his half-sister Diana. He gives her money, drives her to the store, plays piggyback with her, caresses her cheek. He teaches her to dance. They play rhymes together. Unlike Diana, who can be selfish, Enrique is generous. I have a secret to tell you. I love you, he tells her. Still, with his third New Year in the United States, Enrique resolves to change. He can no longer wallow in what happened in the past. He must live in the present and for the future. He's not hurting Lourdes as much as he is hurting himself. Drinking so much alcohol makes his stomach ache constantly. He's tired of going to work after spending all night out drinking. He wants to look better when Maria Isabel comes to the United States. Most important, he has to be more responsible for Jasmin. He can't have her grow up worrying about money as he did. He wants her to study. He can no longer blow hundreds of dollars in a single night of partying or thousands on troubles with the police. That has been a huge waste of money. If he doesn't change, he will repeat his mother's mistake. Time will slip by, and Jasmin will grow up without him. He must save $50,000 as quickly as possible to buy a house and start a business in Honduras. Enrique starts working 7 days a week. Bit by bit, he cuts back on beer and marijuana. He used to go out 3 or more times a week. Now it's just once or twice a month to play pool. He drinks a few beers, then switches to Pepsi. When friends call on his cell phone, beckoning him to party, he tells them he's not interested anymore. He stops playing his music loud and slamming doors. When he burps, he excuses himself. He eats dinner with Lourdes. On Saturday nights, they watch the Spanish language variety show, Sábado Gigante, together, as they did when he first arrived. He tells friends he'll quit beer and drugs altogether when Maria Isabel is at his side. He hopes to bring her next year, get married. He cuts his hair really short and loses weight. He wishes he could fix all the lingering effects of his beating on the train. The scars on his forehead and knees. The bump under the skin by his left eye. The pain in his teeth any time he eats anything hot or cold. Maybe he can at least get caps put on his broken teeth. Honduras. Lourdes's sister, Miriam, is in trouble. She is out of work. Her sister, Ana Lucia, offers her $50 a month to take care of her youngest child. The money falls short. Only another sister, Rosa Amalia, holds hunger at bay. Each Saturday, she brings Enrique's grandmother milk, cheese, butter, rice, sugar, beans, and vegetables. Mirjan can no longer buy construction paper for her children's projects at school. Many mornings she doesn't have money for the school's midday meal. Those days she keeps the children home. Sometimes they are absent from school 3 days in a row. Each of her three children owns one pair of shoes, purchased on a layaway plan. She owes the grocery store up the block so much money it cuts off her line of credit. She worries that her children are eating too much of the food her sister brings over for Enrique's grandmother. When Mirjan walks her children down the block, they beg her to buy them a soda or an ice cream cone. She cannot. "I can't stand this situation anymore," Mirjan tells Belki. She wants to go to the United States. She'll go just long enough to save money to fix up her mother's house and add on a room for her own beauty parlor. She'll go for a few years and return before her children miss her much. They won't feel abandoned. Lourdes is alarmed when she hears that Mirjan wants to set out for the north on her own. "No way," Lourdes tells her. Lourdes's boyfriend now pays the rent, and Lourdes has recently landed a better-paying factory job. Somehow Lourdes and her boyfriend will come up with the money for a smuggler. One morning, 3 years after Enrique left Honduras, Mirjan sits her three children down to say goodbye. "I'm going to the States. You will stay with your grandma." She tells them she is going to work and send them money, clothes, and toys. She cries. So does her oldest, 9-year-old Michelle. Junior, 7, asks when she is coming back. She cannot say. "But are you coming back?" he presses. "Yes." Mirjan steps off the same porch Lourdes left from 14 years before. Her youngest child is 2.5 years old. She still breastfeeds. The girl used to sleeping with her mother cries for Mirjan that night. Belki takes her into her bed. For the first time, Belki understands her own mother's choice to leave her as a young child. She has watched Mirjan's plight. She has seen her grapple with the gut-wrenching decision to leave. She agrees with Mirjan's decision. Meanwhile, Maria Isabel's life has just gotten much better. A relative who lives in the cinder block house next door moves out. Maria Isabel and her family move in temporarily. They raise their old wood hut. Maria Isabel's brother begins to construct a cinder block home of their own. The relative's home isn't a vast improvement. The tin roof is held down with large rocks. A torn sheet offers privacy in the bathroom, which has no door. Occasionally, a mouse climbs up the gray walls. Still, it has two small bedrooms. Now, Maria Isabel shares a full-size bed with only her mother, sister, and Jasmin. In the hallway, which doubles as a living room and kitchen, Eva celebrates how far they've come. She proudly hangs 4 elementary school diplomas her children have earned, including Maria Isabel's. Maria Isabel's relationship with Enrique is coming unglued. Enrique used to send her money monthly, but in the year and a half since Maria Isabel has returned to live with her mother, Enrique has wired money only 4 times, usually between $150 and $180. Enrique is struggling financially. Fed up with the cramped conditions in his mother's apartment and their constant fights, yearning for some scrap of privacy, he has moved out and rented a bedroom in a trailer. Rent on his share of the trailer and utilities is $280. The payments on his used pickup truck and insurance run $580 a month, plus $200 in gas. His cell phone is $50 a month, and he gives his mother $200 a month for lunch and dinner, which he has at her house each night. Fixed costs eat up more than half of the $2,400 to $2,600 a month he makes. He's had to pay 2 police tickets. Sometimes, when work is slow, Lourdes has to loan him money for his truck payment. Maria Isabel knows none of this. She wonders if Enrique sends his daughter less money because he is spending it on another girlfriend. Enrique swears that there is no one else. Gloria warns Maria Isabel, I know you adore Enrique, but don't grow old waiting for him. If he doesn't send for you or return to Honduras soon, find someone else before you lose your looks. Maria Isabel has heard that Enrique drinks too much beer. It's hard to stay away from those drugs, she says. Before, when Enrique told her he was clean, she could ferret out the truth for herself. Now that he is far away, all she has is his word. Right after Enrique left, she felt desperate to be with him again. Over time, she has adapted to his absence. She has not dated anyone else, she says. When a neighbor in the brick house up the hill calls down that Enrique is on the line, Maria Isabel sprints over. Still, when she gets on the telephone, she cries less. She has matured, changed. Now her life revolves around her daughter. I love him, she says, but not like before. Equally troubling, Enrique calls less frequently. Since she moved into her mother's hut, Enrique has rung at the neighbor's house only 5 times. She feels snubbed. It feels as though the phone calls have become a one-way street. She stops calling Enrique as well. Both are stuck in their pride. He hasn't hired a smuggler because she hasn't asked for one. She hasn't said yes to coming because he hasn't hired a smuggler. They are drifting apart. She has tired of spending Sunday morning, her sole day off, downtown at the storefront internet store, dialing Enrique. The manager types the number into one of the gray computers. $3 buys 15 minutes. Hello, my beautiful girl, he coos at Maria Isabel. Hello, how are you? He asks how Jasmine is. I love you. Do you have another boyfriend there, he asks. No, Maria Isabel answers. Enrique wishes she could be more affectionate on the telephone. Maria Isabel knows he wants her to say she loves him, but she can't. She has always been painfully shy. She feels inhibited in the internet store. When she first moved back into Ava's, Maria Isabel went to call Enrique every other week. Now they go 2 months without speaking. She brushes it off as a scheduling problem, or she rationalizes, I call him when he calls me. Enrique no longer talks of returning to Honduras. He tells her he likes the comforts of the United States. He hints that he wants her to come north soon. Yet the more attached Maria Isabel becomes to Jasmine, the more she resists leaving her. United States. After a few weeks, Miriam reaches the United States and settles in with Lourdes. She buys fake identification papers and quickly lands a restaurant job making biscuits. She nets $245 a week. She tells Lourdes that she will be there 3 years, no more. She doesn't buy any furniture. She won't let herself adjust to the comforts of life in the United States, such as hot water. She takes cold showers. She constantly reminds herself of the things she dislikes about the United States. Children live confined indoors. Diana spends her afternoons and evenings chatting with friends on the internet or watching television. In Honduras, Miriam's children play outside and come indoors only when they get hungry. U.S. immigration agents raid Walmarts around the country for illegal immigrants. Miriam frets about being deported. She doesn't like the way people from North Carolina look at her in public sometimes. As if she were inferior, different. On her days off, she stays in. In Honduras, each Sunday after church, Enrique's family takes Miriam's children to the airport, where they call their mother from a computer telephone. Study a lot, don't fight, be good to your grandma, Miriam tells them. Junior tells her he often feels like crying. He tells her he cannot sleep well at night. Quick-minded and chatty, he also tells Miriam about his excellent report card. Then he asks her to send him a bicycle. Miriam says she's sending Nike shoes and Spider-Man, Hulk, Batman, and Barbie dolls. I've bought beautiful things to send you. Mirjam's youngest is frightened when she hears her mother's voice on the telephone. For the first month, she pushes the telephone away. She hears her cousins call Mirjam Auntie on the telephone. When she finally talks to her mother, she starts calling her mother Auntie too. I'm not your aunt, I'm your mother, Mirjam corrects her. No, you're my auntie, the girl insists. Enrique shares the trailer with two Mexican couples. They have four young children. They are a constant reminder of Jasmin. Inside his bedroom, Enrique tapes two pictures of his daughter to his armoire mirror. One of her in a blue and white dress, another in a red and white dress. Two more framed pictures of her are on the shelf by his bed. He didn't like school. He worries. Will she be the same? Enrique loves sweets. Whenever he buys some, he thinks of buying candy for Jasmin. Nearly every day he sees things she might like. He tells himself he would buy them for her if she were there. He talks about her constantly to his friends. His happiest moments are when photographs arrive, or when Maria Isabel puts Jasmin on the line. Te quiero, papi, Jasmin says. I love you, Daddy. He knows Maria Isabel prompts Jasmin to say nice things to him. He doesn't care. In the end, she'll understand what's what. I'm your daddy. Do you love your daddy? Enrique asks. Yes, I love you. She asks him to send things. Papi, I want a piñata, one with candy inside. I think she'll love me when she sees me, he tells himself. He pictures how their lives together will be. Everyone in Lourdes's house eats dinner at different hours, whenever they get home from work. His family will eat dinner together. Honduras. As Jasmin turns three, she is inseparable from her mother. At night, they sleep in the same bed. In the morning, before she readies herself for work, Maria Isabel bathes her daughter with buckets of water and plaits her hair into two braids. When Maria Isabel heads off to work, Jasmin is in tears. Mommy, mommy, she cries. Barefoot, she scrambles down the ravine after her mother. Her grandmother dashes after her and grabs her. Ya vuelvo, I'll be right back, Maria Isabel calls up the hill as she walks away. At night, when Maria Isabel climbs back up the hill, Jasmin runs to her. She sits on her lap, her hands draped around her mother's neck. They rub noses. They play patty cake. Maria Isabel asks Jasmin to count to 10. With each number, she hoists her girl up in the air, then down. Oh, you're getting so heavy! Jasmin grabs her mother's hair, her ears. She squeals with delight. What did you do today? Maria Isabel asks. Did you take a nap today? In a sweet, squeaky voice, Jasmin answers each of her mother's questions. On Maria Isabel's day off, Jasmin is always at her side. Maria Isabel takes her daughter by the hand. They go downtown or to visit Gloria. She walks her down the sidewalk by Pizza Hut, crowded with carts piled with potatoes, plantains, and avocados. It is where Lourdes once sold gum and candy from a little box, with Enrique at her side. She carries Jasmin in her arms to the city's central plaza, where children beg with outstretched arms. She takes her into the cathedral, up to the gilded altar. She prays. She asks that Jasmin not get sick, that Enrique stay away from drugs. Then she takes Jasmin for a scoop of ice cream. Today, Sunday, she readies Jasmin for a friend's birthday party. She dresses her in a pink and white outfit and the gold hoop earrings, bracelet, and pendant of Jesus her father sent. As they walk across the heart of Tegucigalpa, Jasmin is a chatterbox. At the party, at the corrugated tin shack of Maria Isabel's cousin, Jasmin eats chicken, tries to blow up a red balloon, and borrows a pink bike with training wheels. but after a short while she climbs into her mother's lap. Maria Isabel bounces on her knees. Jasmine strokes her mother's hair and whispers into her ear. Maria Isabel straightens Jasmine's braids. She rocks her in her arms. Jasmine kisses her mother lightly. Jasmine finds a bougainvillea branch blooming with red flowers and brings it to her mother. When it is Jasmine's turn to swat at the pink, dog-shaped piñata with a wooden stick, Maria Isabel cheers her on. Hit it hard, hard. She helps her get a piece of cake, then lines her up for her bag of party favors. She shows her how to blow a whistle, one of the gifts. At dusk, they take a bus home, Jasmine in Maria Isabel's arms. Lights twinkle on the hills of Tegucigalpa. Maria Isabel undresses Jasmine and slips on her white nightgown. Jasmine dumps her bag of party favors on the floor, eager to see what is inside. There are two butterfly hairpins. Maria Isabel puts them in Jasmine's hair. Jasmine dances to the music from the family's small television, twizzling her hips, her hands in the air. At 7:30 p.m., Maria Isabel climbs into bed with her daughter. Jasmine holds a bottle of milk with her left hand. With the right hand, she rubs her mother's belly. It is a ritual. She cannot fall asleep without stroking her mother's belly. Slowly, as she sucks on the milk, Jasmine loses her grip on the bottle. Her eyes flutter. Maria Isabel rolls her over and rubs Jasmine's back until the girl falls asleep. She can no longer imagine leaving her daughter. She has to tell Enrique. At most, she might leave Jasmine when she is old enough to understand what is happening. She would have to be at least 5 years old for me to leave her. Then at least I could try to explain it to her, Maria Isabel tells her family. Not a day before, she says firmly. It is the same age Enrique was when his mother left. Some of her friends tell her she would be a fool not to follow Enrique to the United States. She is young and can find work now, but women over the age of 25 or 28 are no longer considered for many jobs in Honduras. Something made clear in newspaper employment ads. One factory, S.J. Mariol, hires only women ages 18 to 25, says Lady Karina Lopez, head of human resources at the company. In the large brick building in Tegucigalpa, young women sit in rows behind sewing machines, furiously stitching medical scrubs for export to the United States. One woman sews a triangle at the bottom of the neck. She does it 2,520 times a day, 44 hours a week, for $110 a month. We look at the work, and it requires a lot of energy and dedication. At 30, they might have back problems or eye problems or arthritis. We want to avoid that, Lopez says. Without high productivity, she says, the work will move to lower-wage countries such as China. The children's store Maria Isabel works at won't hire women older than 23. Middle-aged women have three options, says Argentina Norma Valeriano, Maria Isabel's neighbor. Washing and ironing clothes, cleaning houses, or making tortillas at home. Jobs that pay $50 to $90 a month. A family needs $350 a month minimum, says a social worker, Francis Jeanette Gomez Irias, with the Instituto Hondureño de la Niñez y la Familia. In 1998, Hurricane Mitch caused many Honduran businesses to go under. Unemployment and sub-unemployment combined now affect 43% of Hondurans. Government jobs go to people in certain families or with good connections, says Norma. Most of Maria Isabel's neighbors, including 25 on her block, have no work, she adds. They survive only because someone in the family has gone north and sends back money. The children of single mothers suffer most, she says. Maria Isabel wouldn't be the first in her family to go to the United States and leave children behind. Her aunt, Eva's sister Tina, left 4 children in Honduras to go to Los Angeles in the early 1980s. Maria Isabel's eldest sister, Olga, went to Houston in 1990. She left Jose, 1.5 years old, and Denis Alexander, 3, with her mother, Eva. For 8 years, Olga sent Eva $50 or $100 a month to help her raise the boys. In 1998, Eva's other sister, Laura, left 2 children behind. Eventually, the 3 women were able to bring their children to the United States, some legally, others with smugglers. When Maria Isabel sees couples walking down the street with their children, it saddens her. If she went to the United States, would it allow Jasmin to have both her parents at her side more quickly? Jasmin, she knows, needs her father. Jasmin has taken to calling the only man in Ava's house, her 27-year-old uncle, Miguel, Papi. With Enrique, Jasmin has to be coached to talk. With Miguel, words of affection come naturally. One evening, Jasmin returns from a friend's birthday party. She runs to Miguel with a bag full of candy, a party treat. Papi, Jasmin says, handing him pieces of the candy. Papi tenga, here, Daddy. She doesn't normally share her candy. With Miguel, she is generous. She gives him a full report of the day. How she hit the piñata, ate rice and cake, drank soda, how people took pictures. Jasmin runs and flops on his bed. Miguel chases her, tickling her ribs. Many afternoons, when Maria Isabel is away at work, Jasmin eludes her grandmother and wanders next door, where Miguel is constructing the family's new house. She climbs the ladder to the 2nd floor. There she serves as Miguel's little assistant. As he lays floor tiles, Miguel points to the sponge. Jasmin brings it. He points to a flat spatula. She brings that too. Pass me the hammer, he says in his gentle voice. When Miguel heads down the hill at dusk to play soccer, he says, Me voy, Jasmin. I'm off, Jasmin. She quickly answers, Vamos, papi. Let's go, daddy. Enrique senses that his daughter has begun to identify someone else as her father. Late in the year, as Christmas approaches, he promises her he'll come visit. Maria Isabel sees even more reasons to stay in Honduras with her daughter. A year-long government advertising campaign has highlighted the dangers of the journey. Newspapers carry a stream of accounts of people injured or killed during the trek north. Maria Isabel's sister, Irma, tried to make it to the United States but ran out of money in Mexico and had to turn back. So did one of her brothers. Maria Isabel asks one of her sisters about her trip. She tells her she was often hungry. Maria Isabel asks if she was raped. The sister doesn't answer. What if she doesn't make it? What would become of her daughter? She'd have to live illegally in the United States, always fearful of being caught and deported. There is racism. She would be treated as inferior. Her mother emphasizes that the United States is a cold place, where neighbors barely know one another. She doesn't want to miss all the important moments in Jasmin's life. She thinks about everything Enrique has already missed. Soon Jasmin will attend her first day of kindergarten. Maria Isabel has heard how mothers who leave lose the love of their children. Rosa Amalia, who raised Enrique's sister Belki, has seen the effects of these separations. She advises Maria Isabel to wait until Jasmin is older, when Enrique might be able to bring them both together. Maria Isabel devises a plan to stay. If she doesn't have any more children and she works hard, she can give her daughter a shot at a good education. It's not impossible. With one child, I can give her what she wants, Maria Isabel says. I'm not leaving without Jasmin, she tells Gloria. Belki has secretly been seeing a new boyfriend, Giovanni. Eventually, Giovanni goes to Rosa Amalia, who has raised Belki, to pedir la llegada, ask for permission to date. Rosa Amalia agrees after Giovanni vows chastity. Rosa Amalia wants Belki to stop living in limbo, always fixating on reunifying with her mother. She hopes she will finish her studies in business administration and eventually form her own family in Honduras. Belki begins to think that if she doesn't see her mother soon, she will never see her. I just want to give her a hug. A bunch of hugs. I just want to be by her side, even if it's for a short while, she says. One night, Giovanni proposes as they sit outside her cinderblock hut. Giovanni is not handsome. He lives with his mother, a tamale maker, in a tiny wooden shack. But he is kind, drinks rarely, and buys her little presents. He treats her like a queen. She loves him. Belki asks Lourdes to provide a few $1,000s to build a tiny house on land beside her grandmother's home, land reserved for the house Lourdes was to build upon her return. When she marries, her mother won't be there. Her aunt and uncle will walk her down the aisle. United States. Lourdes works on a cleaning crew, then on a factory assembly line. It is hard living with so many people jammed into her apartment, especially because the men don't help. When she arrives home, the kitchen trash is full, the floors are dirty, and she must cook and clean for everyone. Although the men come home at different hours, Lourdes waits up to serve each of them dinner. On her day off, she takes the men's laundry, 6 baskets, to the laundromat. On Sunday, she buys $300 in groceries, enough to last the clan a week. Having 7 people split the cost of the 3-bedroom apartment, which costs $800 a month, allows Lourdes to send money back to her daughter and mother in Honduras. To Lourdes, it seems as though every relative in Honduras who has money troubles thinks they can ask her for help. One night, Enrique and a friend start talking about gangs in Honduras. Lourdes says that Honduras is a horrible, lawless place. Enrique chafes at such talk, especially from Lourdes. It is your country, he says. Mom, I don't know why you hate your country so much. I'll never go back, she says. The discussion devolves into another big fight. For the 3rd time since he arrived, Enrique accuses Lourdes of abandoning him in Honduras. He tells her his true mother is his grandmother, Maria. Enrique has hung a picture of the Last Supper above the headboard of his bed. It reminds him of her. His grandmother had several pictures of the Last Supper hanging in her hut. He misses the beans and spaghetti she made for him. He misses going to church with her as a child. Lourdes believes that Enrique's comments reveal a fear. If he goes back to Central America, his mother will not follow him. They will once again live apart. Lourdes's boyfriend tries to find a way to alleviate the sadness he sees in Lourdes. Mira, honey, he says, tome la distancia. Look, honey, put some distance between you. It's no use arguing and fighting with Enrique, he tells her. It's a fight you will not win. You're both equally stubborn. Neither of you likes to be contradicted or told he is wrong. You have to control your anger when Enrique baits you. If Enrique does something she doesn't like, Lourdes ignores it. She still cooks his dinner, but no longer serves him his plate of food. She stops doing his laundry. They no longer routinely go out to dinner on Saturday night or grocery shopping on Sunday. With the new year, Lourdes, her boyfriend, and their relatives decide to leave North Carolina. The paint firm where most of the men work is in financial trouble and has cut back on everyone's hours. Jobs are scarce. They move to Florida, where a cousin of Lourdes's boyfriend gets everyone painting jobs. Lourdes and her sister Miriam start as hotel maids for $6.50 an hour. Each cleans 16 to 18 rooms per shift. 8 people cram into a small 2-bedroom apartment. Enrique sleeps on the living room sofa. He hates it. He misses his friends in North Carolina. He has to get up before dawn to be painting by 6:30 a.m. Lourdes's sister, Marianne, toys with the idea of bringing her children to the United States, but quickly dismisses it as too dangerous. She switches to a job washing dishes for $9 an hour. She focuses on saving enough to return to her children in what she hopes will be another 2 years. She needs to save $10,000 to $15,000 to add a beauty salon to her mother's house and send her 3 children to school. So far, she has banked $1,200. Enrique constantly nags Miriam to go back. "Why are you going to abandon your kids?" he asks her. After fights with his mother, Enrique always has a warning for his aunt, Miriam. "This will happen to you because you left your children when they were young. You think that filling our bellies is the same thing as love." As Enrique mulls over returning to North Carolina, he becomes more loving with his mother. He hugs and kisses her often. Finally, he decides to go. Lourdes begs him to stay. She tells him she will not follow him back to North Carolina. She has a life now in Florida with her de facto husband, daughter, and sister. "You've never acknowledged me as a real mother. I have to work at my life with my husband now," she tells Enrique. Enrique quietly packs and leaves. Lourdes wants to enjoy her life more and worry about Enrique less. She and her boyfriend go out Saturday nights to a buffet dinner. Lourdes relishes moments with her daughter, Diana. She teases Diana when she flubs a phrase in Spanish. Diana helps teach her mother English in a southern drawl. Lourdes and her boyfriend can finally afford their own apartment. She'd like to open a paint store with him someday, maybe buy a double-wide trailer. Mostly, she prays for an amnesty for immigrants so she can become legal and bring her daughter Belki to the United States. "God, give me my papers. I want to be with my daughter," she says. "I ask God to give me this before I die." She begins to sob. "Is that so much to ask of God? I don't ask God for riches or other things." In North Carolina, Enrique focuses on working, on saving money, on cutting down even more on drinking and drugs. He'll need $5,000 for a smuggler to bring his girlfriend north. Enrique gently tries to convince Maria Isabel to commit to the move. "Maria Isabel, you know I am very good to you. I give you everything," he tells her on the telephone. He loves her. He misses her serene, calm nature. How much she would cry and giggle. How simple she is. He misses walking her home from school holding her hand. If they live apart too long, Enrique fears, Maria Isabel will find someone else. "If you find someone who loves you as much as I do, go with him," Enrique says. "I left you. I understand." In truth, he desperately wants to hear her protest such talk, to know if she is interested in anyone else. She tells him she loves him for life. Why doesn't she tell him she wants to come be with him? He is reaching his breaking point. He resolves to call her and ask point blank, "Are you coming or not?" He knows Maria Isabel has been stalling, that she is anxious about leaving Jasmin. He's been stalling too. He wants to learn English and get his vices totally under control before bringing her to the United States. Yet the sooner Maria Isabel comes, the easier it will be for both of them to save money and return to Honduras. The sooner he will see his daughter. He is resolved to be with her by the time she is 5, 6 at the latest. If not, Jasmin won't embrace him as her father. "She'll see me as a stranger," he says. He'll go back to Honduras when she is 6, even if it is for a brief visit, and he has to make his way back through Mexico illegally again. "I need to see her, to be with her." As time passes, Enrique sees other things with equal clarity. He knows now that his mother will never offer an apology for leaving him. He tries to put the love he has always felt for Lourdes above the resentment he has harbored all these years. He gives his mother his first gift, $100 for her birthday. She uses it to buy a dress and a bottle of lotion. Enrique and Lourdes start to call each other 2 or 3 times a week to talk. Enrique has long called his mother Señora. Now he says Ma. With each call, he is more loving. Tan bonita mi mami. La quiero mucho. My beautiful mother, I love you so much, he says. Lourdes teases. Mentiroso viejo. You old liar. He even begins to make plans to move from North Carolina to Florida. He does not want to live apart from his mother anymore. Lourdes is sure that God is answering one of her prayers. That Enrique straighten up, stop drinking, and no longer feel so bitter toward her. It's like a miracle, she says. It is as if all the hurt he felt inside had to come out, and now he is ready to move on. She feels the same warmth and love from Enrique as when he first arrived on her doorstep in North Carolina. He always wanted to be with me, she says. The Girl Left Behind. It is spring 2004. Enrique has been gone for 4 years. Enrique and Maria Isabel have not spoken for more than 4 months, since last Christmas. Enrique calls his sister Belki. Go find Maria Isabel, he tells her. Tell her she must call me. Maria Isabel dials from the internet store. Why don't you call me? He asks. She answers curtly that she doesn't have anything to talk about. Are you ready to come? He asks. Maria Isabel tells herself he is joking. When he was sniffing glue in Honduras, he often said things he didn't really mean. Even if he's serious, she can't leave until Jasmin is at least 5 years old. She promised. You must make a decision, Enrique says, now. If not, he vows, he will remake his life, find someone else. I don't want to leave, she tells him. Enrique cajoles. I've changed, he tells her. I drink, but just a little now. I don't use glue. I'm not the same person. She doesn't budge. If you come, he tells her, it will be the best thing for Jasmin. Together, we'll provide her a better life. We'll both be able to return to her sooner. Now she is listening. I'll think about it, she says. Her answer fills Enrique with hope. He starts calling Maria Isabel constantly. I need you, he says. You're the mother of my child. You're the only one I want to marry. Day and night, Maria Isabel turns it over in her mind. If she stays and marries, her husband would never treat Jasmin as if she were his own. Maria Isabel decides, in the long run, leaving will help Jasmin. Eventually, she will be with her real mother and father, everyone together. She strikes a deal with Enrique. Jasmin will live with Belki, but spend weekends with her mother. I will do it for my daughter, she says. A few days later, word reaches Maria Isabel from a smuggler. He will call next week, probably on Tuesday or Wednesday. She must be ready. Maria Isabel hauls all of Jasmin's clothing and dolls over to the cinder block hut, where Belki lives behind her grandmother's home. She waits next door at Gloria's for the smuggler to call Rosa Amalia, who has just gotten hooked up to phone service. She hugs her daughter over and over. She cries and cries. Jasmin asks, why are you crying so much, Mommy? Maria Isabel tells Jasmin her arm hurts. She tells her a cavity in her mouth aches. Don't cry, Mommy, Jasmin says. Saddened by her mother's tears, Jasmin cries too. Why are you crying? Rosa Amalia asks the girl. Because my mommy is crying. My mommy cries all the time. Maria Isabel hasn't told her daughter she is leaving. She can't. Still, Jasmin is bright. A neighbor asks Maria Isabel, "Are you leaving already?" Jasmin asks, "Where is my mother going?" She asks her mother why she has moved all her clothes from her grandmother Eva's to Belki's hut across town. "Why," she asks her mother, "has Maria Isabel packed a white backpack with her own clothes?" "I'm going out," Maria Isabel says. "I'll be right back." "Where are you going?" "I'm going downtown." "Are you coming back?" "Yes." Jasmin believes her. And this time she does come back. Sometimes when Jasmin asks if her mother is coming back, Maria Isabel is silent. She does not answer. She doesn't like lying to Jasmin. But Maria Isabel is sure her daughter is too young, at 3 1/2, to understand the truth. She can't handle a scene, demands by Jasmin to take her with her. She doesn't want to see her daughter cry. This is easier, better, Maria Isabel tells herself. Wednesday. The smuggler calls at 1 p.m. Maria Isabel must be across town at Tegucigalpa's main bus station at 3:30 p.m. The smuggler says he will be wearing a red shirt and blue jeans. What will Maria Isabel have on? A black blouse and blue jeans, Enrique's family tells him. Maria Isabel heads back to Belki's hut with Jasmin. She holds her in her arms and gives her a last bottle of milk. Maria Isabel heads over to Enrique's grandmother's. "I'm leaving now. Goodbye," she says. "God bless you," the grandmother says. "The family will pray for her during her journey north," she tells her. Next door at Gloria's, Maria Isabel hugs her mother and sister. Enrique's aunt Rosa Amalia takes Jasmin back to Belki's hut, hoping to prevent a scene. Jasmin will have none of it. She's overheard some of the goodbyes. That Rosa Amalia is driving Maria Isabel to the bus terminal. I'm coming to drop off my mother," she tells Rosa Amalia, who relents. Jasmin runs to the car and gets in. Maria Isabel takes the backpack, which contains a change of clothes and one picture of her daughter. Belki and her boyfriend climb in too. At the bus terminal, Rosa Amalia won't let Jasmin get out of the car. Only passengers are allowed beyond the waiting room. Maria Isabel is relieved. She tells herself that it is all right, that Jasmin doesn't really understand what is happening. Maria Isabel does not say goodbye to her daughter. She does not hug her. She gets out of the car and walks briskly into the bus terminal. She does not look back. She never tells her she is going to the United States. Rosa Amalia lifts Jasmin onto the hood of her car. As the bus pulls out of the terminal, she tells the girl to say goodbye. Jasmin waves with both hands and calls out, "Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy! Adios, mommy!"